football on off the ball.
To start with my brother from another mother, Patrick Kluivert, you had Edgar Davids, you had Frank Rijkaard, you had, and if I need to name one, Frank Rijkaard was of course the man.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
The Formula One Pod on Off the Ball. Brought to you by KitKat. Hit pause. Have a break.
Have a KitKat.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the F1 Pod. And if you've been following the action this season and are in need of a reset, why not hit the brakes and pause to enjoy a KitKat junkie, have a break, have a KitKat. This is a lovely episode to be having after what was an eventful Monaco Grand Prix. I'm joined as always by Kira Tracy. How are you?
Hello, I'm great. I never want to hear anyone call Monaco boring again after the weekend.
For the right or wrong reasons.
Yeah.
And then delighted to have in studio Declan Quigley. How are you today?
Hi, Eve. Hi, Kira. Great to be here. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good that we have a kind of a nice full house in studio to discuss what was a bit of a manic Monaco weekend. I mean, just I guess to touch on what you said there, there is this stereotype that Monaco is not suited to these modern cars, that it is a procession, that qualifying is most exciting. But the excitement that we got in this race was really not from the racing as much as all the chaos around it.
It's a daft place to have a car race, isn't it? I mean, it's completely nuts. And they wouldn't, I mean, obviously in 1929 it made some sense. Now it's crazy. I mean, they it's a bit of a cliche, but they say all of Monaco's on Saturday for qualifying.
Yeah.
The first time I went, I was a kid, and a friend of mine, he was going to bring a girl and she couldn't go, so I got a cheap trip to Monaco. And we spent all the money that we had spare. I was an impoverished student on Saturday going to Café de Paris, and we went up on the roof of that, and I was hugely distracted because there's a massive buffet lunch beside me, and then the car F1 cars are qualifying, and I hadn't seen them too often at that point. It was a relatively rare thing, but we spent all the money so we could see qualifying, see the F3000 race, see the F3 race, and then went up on the hillside for the race the following day because everyone said the race is boring. And that one was weird because it was 89 and they blocked the track. There was a crash, the whole track got blocked. Right. It was kind of famous. I mean, it's one of those ones that people talk about, but yeah, it bucked the trend a little bit, didn't it, this week? It was a mad old Sunday, and yes, serenely through it all, Kimi Antonelli doing his own thing.
So there's a 68-point difference here between George and Antonelli, and he's also clear of the championship, 66 points. No driver's ever been able to cover that deficit between 68 points between another driver. You know, these records are made to be broken. Will George be able to catch Antonelli?
Of course he can. I mean, there's loads and loads of races left at this point. 22 races still, the total season, and we've only got, six under our belt at this point. Yeah, he absolutely can. And you have to remember, he was dominant in the first race, wasn't he? Mm. I mean, he probably could have gone and won in Montreal, so it's not a catastrophe just yet. And he's been around since 2019, so this is the biggest pressure he's ever been under. And I'd say he's slightly bamboozled, shell-shocked. I think he's used the word bamboozled, hasn't he?
It's a very George Russell term.
So George-coded.
Yeah, head boy, yes. Yeah. Definitely a very Declan Quigley term as well, to be honest, yeah. He's slightly discombobulated and befuddled and bewildered and lots of things with bees. Anyway, I'm sure he is wondering, but what Antonelli did in Monaco was on a different scale. That was by miles his best performance. Stuck it on pole. Russell has a mare, manages to get ahead of Verstappen, who is still the benchmark, isn't he? I mean, you know, he's drags something out of that car. Final practice, they're nowhere, and then suddenly in qualifying, he's just manages to drag. So had Verstappen had a decent run, actually got any sort of run, it would have been interesting to see how that race played out. But I mean, Antonelli did weird things. Instead of backing up the pack and then going, you know, and then sprinting away ahead of his pit stop, he decides to just do qualifying runs. And they're having to, I mean, it was funny, wasn't it, to hear Peter Bonington on the pit wall just saying, now we don't need fastest laps. So I mean, he's very school teachery about it, wasn't it? I mean, it was very avuncular, or sort of definitely a father figure way of talking to a guy who's only 19.
It reminds me of a young Vettel who used to just do that the whole time.
Yeah.
I don't want to just win this race. I want to be as fast as I can possibly be. And it's just funny to see it around Monaco.
It's delightfully inexperienced and irresponsible. I mean, it is, even on the last lap, wasn't it? He gave it a little bit of a squirt through Roscas and through Anthony Nogue on that, oh my God, that treacherous tarmac, which they were all told was the reason they were crashing. And they're saying, no, 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 it's the brakes. You know, but that was another topic. Yeah, I mean, Antonelli is... He was cool, calm. I mean, we have seen him have little offs in dodgy little moments in Canada. I'm trying to think about and you know where he has been cruising to victory and he's made a little mistake or didn't kind of really do that.
The sprint race incidents with Russell in the past couple of weekends, that sort of almost childlike petulance of, well, give him a penalty, he hit me off track.
Yeah.
But at the same time, when you are performing so consistently and wanting every point at every opportunity this early on, I think his mindset is in exactly the right place, and to have very little, I don't want to say pressure on his shoulders, obviously there's huge pressure on his shoulders, but I think it takes a very young driver to be able to go around Monaco in the qualifying lap like he did.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's the sort of the brio of youth, isn't it? I mean, it's that sort of unwilling, sort of disregard for the consequences, which is very impressive because... when he came in, they said, OK, we're going to sign this young wunderkind. He's going to be amazing. And then he went out in Monza, wasn't it, and binned it in free practice. And they're going, oh, God, that was such a good thing. And then even his first season, I mean, he had a load of retirements. He had sort of mechanical issues, didn't he? I think when he went to Spain this time last year, he was on a run of three failures. Or, you know, so it was... He was being out-qualified consistently by George Russell. Different car, you know, the ground effect car. I mean, the new car is clearly suiting him, and that's something that you always need to kind of factor in. The best, the very, very best will figure out a way to adapt. Verstappen being a case in point, hates the current car because it's slow, or at least relatively slow. But they generally get there. But, I mean, I think it is something maybe to factor in that Russell hasn't quite figured this one out just yet.
I thought the visual of Toto Wolff up on the podium with Antonelli at the end of the race too, celebrating his first time on a podium, you know, with one of his drivers in 10 years. Accidental. He said there was a board member who was meant to go up with Antonelli but had to get an early flight. So he jumped on and he felt quite uneasy about that because George has just had, you know, an unfortunate race for him. And I wonder if that's going to play into the psychology a little bit too of this kind of like, the nestling of Antonelli that he's really cherished in that team. Do you know, I feel like... Yeah. He was meant to be a kind of second to George, but it doesn't really feel like that anymore.
They're still trying to, you know, peddle the narrative. Oh, it's not for the championship this year. He's young, you know. Oh, come on, it's way too early to talk about that. I mean, that's ridiculous at this
68
point.
68 points ahead, begs to differ.
Of Russell, yes. Yeah, so it's... You wonder how they're going to change that sort of public... I mean, does it make any difference, really? He's thinking about the championship. Yeah. We're thinking about it. We're
100%.
Talking about it.
That's all we're talking about, really, it feels.
Well, I'll be interested to see how the European swing goes for Antonelli because it was, as you alluded to there, so disappointing last year. You know, little mistakes, a lot of bad luck.
Yeah.
And you have Russell coming into, I think we have 5 races in the next 7 weeks. You have Russell coming into a swing of races where he is a lot more experienced. You know, we're going to get Silverstone soon. Yeah. You have races that will probably, tracks maybe that would suit him and that he's familiar with. This really feels like more so than the back end of the season where you need to really push with everything you have. This feels like a moment where Russell needs to be thinking, okay, I need to put my foot down and I need to try and get that 66 points down to a reasonable
race. It's one race at a time. Just needs to beat him. I mean, if he beats him once, then he's, you know, he gets some momentum. It's a momentum game, isn't it? But you're absolutely right. And of course, coming to Barcelona, it's medium high speed corners. Mm-hmm. It's one they know backwards. They have so much data. It's ridiculous. You know, it's probably huge data farm in Offaly or something that's, you know, containing all the data just from Barcelona. So they know so much about it, but it also is going to be one of those. We're back to that super clipping and harvesting and, you know, feathering through medium high speed corners, which is going to be annoying, I suppose, to watch. But it's who's going to manage that. And we could see a little bit of that yo-yo bungee cord overtaking stuff going on as well. And we could potentially see a little bit more of an edge for the Mercs. We'll see how that plays out.
Yeah. So the other kind of big story, I suppose, from the weekend was Ferrari. You had kind of the highs and the lows. You have Lewis Hamilton with another P2.
Yeah.
And I mean, when you kind of sit back and look at Lewis Hamilton at Monaco specifically, how long a journey. I mean, his career, obviously, you're spanning 20 years. But to be still finishing on the podium at Monaco yeah. in his 40s with a team that he was struggling with so much last year. I mean, this is a Lewis Hamilton that has found his feet in this Ferrari team.
Yeah, I mean, found a girlfriend to give him the good luck.
Oh my God, I now know what Kim Kardashian looks like. How amazing. Yeah, yeah. What a valuable asset that is.
How strange. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, who brings their partner to work? I mean, and when you do, with such an entourage, I mean, such an amount of noise. I bet he didn't see her all weekend, or virtually didn't, you know?
Did you see when he sprayed her with champagne and all of a sudden this entourage spring into action? The umbrellas are unfolded, she's running away from it. Whereas I feel like, not to bring this into like a WAG discussion, Nicole Scherzinger was, you know, so into the culture of it, wasn't she?
Right, right. She equally, similarly high profile and
time anyway.
It's a minefield, isn't it? But it's a mad old, I mean, they Formula One drivers, they don't just bring their partners to work, but they also, generally speaking, bring their mums and dads and brothers and sisters.
His mum's travelling around the world with him this year, apparently.
Oh, yeah, which is
that's
quite cool.
Lovely.
To see.
Yeah.
This is the Hamilton, I suppose, that has decided to change up from last year, where it was kind of, he's thinking, that sure obviously didn't work. Yeah. You're not getting the results you want. You have people pressuring you, saying, this is going to be your last year in the car.
Yeah.
And that's a very firm no.
I always said at the end of the year, he'll test this one. And if this one is A, competitive, and B, likes driving it, if he's not sort of breaking his back and, you know, bouncing around the place. So, you know, that ticked the box. It was a relatively nice car to drive, and then it turned out to be half quick, you know. So that's key. And once he likes it, now he's beating Leclerc a couple of times, and at the early age of 41, he's more than double the age of Kimi Antonelli. It's nuts.
It's
we were chatting about this before we came on, but I have always said he is the greatest of all time. He's certainly by miles the greatest of this era, because he's not just incredibly fast and incredibly experienced able to put it all together, but he still wants to. And like that, he wants to, and Fernando Alonso and the points in that awful Aston Martin. I mean,
dreadful.
I mean, it was pretty rough on the Cadillacs not getting their point.
Yeah.
But still, it was really cool to see Alonso. Where did they get the motivation? They don't need the money. They must have nothing else in their lives.
That's what I want to. I suppose that's the question I'm asking myself. What is in it for Hamilton right now? Does he still think he's going to get an eighth championship? Is that why he's in this Ferrari, or is it chasing another win? Is that enough for someone like Lewis Hamilton?
Well, it's funny to see him satisfied with second. I mean, he's absolutely thrilled with a couple of podiums. That just shows you how far he's coming from.
Yeah.
I mean, but his last podium in Monaco was his win in 2019, I think, wasn't it? He's won it three times.
That's
so
crazy.
So it's been a while, you know, and it's been a while since he's had a win in F1 23. So next win is similarly for Russell. It's only about the next race. You know, if once they get the win, then much always wants more. Then you sort of open up your vistas a little bit, and then it'll be a better challenge.
You said next win with such certainty. Do you think it's 100% coming for Hamilton?
Ah, yeah.
If Antonelli's not racing anyway.
It was that.
If Antonelli's not racing as well anyway.
Well, that's it, you know. But the Mercs can break down too.
Yeah.
Like, something that's a bit of a throwback to an earlier era is all this sort of uncertainty around reliability, and the fact that there is a little bit of, you know, they are breaking down and falling off, and you are only getting 10 cars to the finish line. I quite like it too.
Speaking of, you know, breaking down, not working, we talk about a very happy Lewis Hamilton, but Charles Leclerc, on the other hand, was absolutely fuming. This is the first time in a while that he said, this is not my responsibility.
I know,
The brakes are borderline dangerous, is what he actually said. He really was not impressed. He fully said, I am not having any part of this responsibility after you crashed out in Monaco. How do you think he's feeling, and what can Ferrari do? I know they're putting him on the same brake configuration as Hamilton.
Yeah.
Could this be the fix for Charles?
Well, he says when he does that, then at least he's less likely to have a brake issue, but will he be as fast? I mean, from what I understand, he's a little bit more gentle on the brakes than Hamilton. Hamilton hops off them. He can get in deep. He's always been a good overtaker, hasn't he? And by which I mean, it's almost not quite, but 2 feet on the thing, and, you know, the biggest leg press that you've ever seen in your life to try and stop those. And the relative difference between what Hamilton and Leclerc is doing is virtually nothing. But I think that's the issue. The back brakes are, you know, coming off a safety car and a red flag restart. they're cold. They're getting used so little because there's so much engine braking through the powertrain in order to harvest energy. It's something that's happening in road cars, actually. I mean, I don't know if you're sort of driving EVs, but, you know, everyone's driving around one pedal, so they just throttle on, you know, when they're in eco mode. Throttle off and you suddenly feel that sort of that resistance, and that's more or less what's happening. And in the road car industry, you're having cars on regular service intervals coming in, and the rear brakes are like, they're kind of rusty because the discs haven't been used.
Yeah.
So it's a very unusual situation, and it's a factor of these new rules and the way that it's shifted more towards the electric power this year.
So it's funny, you kind of think of F1 as the series which pioneers developments that will eventually kind of drift down to road cars, but now we're having the same issue.
But
it's funny, and we mentioned it earlier, that both Leclerc and Stroll crash in that exact same place, going by that tarmac on the track which was so damaged, and yet both, and you had Anthony Davidson at Sky Race Control saying, well, that's the reason they crashed, I've solved it, and then both drivers coming out and saying, no, it was the brakes.
Yeah, but I'm not sure if they had all the info. I mean, I'm absolutely certain they had brake problems, and they probably had brake problems most of the race and for the previous five before that, and that's just sort of hardwired into them now, is this horrible thing that they're having to deal with. But then you add in the factor of not just regular rubber marbles, but the sort of little bits of bitumen that are, you know, have been torn up there at the no-guess corner. I'm sure that's what ultimately tipped them over the edge. So I think at the moment that they gave those interviews, they couldn't be swayed from the idea that it was their brakes, which was no doubt had played a role.
Yeah.
But I think, I think ultimately it was the track breaking up.
I mean, when you look at a track like Monaco, which is, I mean, Formula E was there a while ago, F2 and F3, then you get to F1. And you think it's the most prestigious track that attracts still the most attention and the most kind of fanfare, and to have it break up at such a vital point in the track. I mean, it's
funny.
It kind of defies belief.
I was thinking about it actually before the race, because, again, showing my age, but I remember Spa 84, was it, or 5? Might be 85. When the track broke up in the Formula 3000 race and they all had to go home. The Formula 1 didn't get to run. Mm. And they went back, I think, later in the year or something. And it's happened. It used to happen relatively regularly that they would resurface the track. And then they said, enough of this. We've got to run another race. But, you know, resurface the track, let it cure. It would take months to do it. And then they'd run some sort of a race just to make sure everything was okay. And then it didn't happen anymore. And then, with the development in sort of materials, actually, they can cure the track really quickly. So that surface was laid only within the last few weeks. And I remember thinking, wow, how amazing that things have come on. And they didn't resurface the whole track as well. It was just that patch, wasn't it? I mean, there were other patches around the track as well. It got to within 20 laps, more or less, of the finish of the Grand Prix, after the GP2, after the Formula 3s, after all of that practice running as well. Yeah.
And speaking of certain aspects of the track and the race being overlooked, something that we have to talk about, all of the flags that we had, all of the penalties that were applied in Monaco. There were 15 different times where the FIA were like, no, we have an issue, no, we have an issue, whether it was collisions, whether it was speed limits or red flag infringements. There were so many issues. Why was that? And should that be happening at this level, you know, at this level of the sport?
When something like this happens, everyone says, well, you know, they've got so much resource, so much money. Why does it happen? Because they take it to the nth. They'll take it to the absolute, because everything matters to the most minute detail. So the idea that, you know, they have taken it to the limit of, and, you know, why not just throttle back a little bit and leave a little bit of a margin? Well, then you find yourself losing one place.
Yeah.
And then suddenly that guy in front of you isn't able to keep up and you end up 25 seconds behind where you could have been. So everything is down to the end. However, in this instance, and there is a bit I don't understand, but what we're given to understand is there's a little bit of a bend in the pit lane.
Yeah.
So it was all the pit lane penalties
due to the Cadillac garage, was it?
There's a slight kind of rejigging of the pit lane, and they were
which called everyone out.
They were taking a little bit of a shortcut, something like that.
Straight lining it.
Yes.
And of course the measurement was on a sort of the middle of the road with a little bit of a wiggle and sort of but what is remarkable is that they are measuring pit lane speed limit as an average speed.
Yeah, as opposed to just
as opposed
actual...
to being able to put a speed gun on them and be able to say, you know, because theoretically, as some people have said, you could go 90 kilometers an hour up to your pit box, get in and get out, and then trundle down in front of the guy that you were behind to the end of the pit lane. Now, I'm not sure that's happening, but potentially that's a way you could exploit it. Make your average speed to the end. And you can be sure someone would think of doing it, would do it if they thought they could get away with it. But yeah, it is.
Because you had Pierre Gasly, obviously, he lost, I put in quotation marks, that podium. Because people who had been ahead of him got penalties and served them and blah, 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 blah. But he went from, what, third to something like seventh.
Yeah.
And the very devastated and then saying, you know, our pit lane limiter brings us in at 59.5 kilometres an hour for 60. There is no way that this isn't... you know, we're gonna kind of go down and measure things, and we're gonna get Alpine to appeal everything. But I mean, it's not gonna even if they say, "Oh yeah, Pierre, you were completely right." He still didn't stand on that podium in Monaco, and I think that's what hurts.
That could happen because tomorrow will be the result of the right review that Alpine put in. Is it?
No.
It's not going to happen at all, is it?
Gonna happen.
I'd be amazed. I mean, they don't have a great history of rowing back on their decisions. I mean, we do think about that Jordan victory in Brazil, where they got the sort of calculation of the count back, and Kimi Raikkonen stood on the podium, and then Giancarlo Fisichella a couple of weeks later in San Marino, or in Imola, we all gathered around and they played the Irish national anthem, and everyone's kind of going, why are they playing that at the beginning of the weekend? So it's not unheard of for a little bit of a reset, but I don't think they're going to, because there were so many penalties for a start.
Yeah.
So it's not like they just need to fix one.
I know.
And they might quietly fix whatever the issue is, but I don't think they're going to change the result of the Monaco Grand Prix.
It's something that frustrates me, and I've mentioned it before on here, the amount of penalties for non-racing incidents that determine so much of, then I understand that, you know, there are rules in place and I understand that. But, you know, you have the FAA saying, we're going to investigate after the race. And then after the race, you might find out that the likes of Sergio Perez is no longer finishing 10th instead of Fernando Alonso.
Yeah.
So that if you're, say, at the race, this is all still provisional.
And it used to be worse, though.
Yeah.
I mean, you're right. It is so frustrating that you're not really sure when you get to the line. And, you know, especially if you're writing a report, or, you know, if you're a journalist, you know. But also, but when you think back, there was a time when this used to happen and there'd be appeal after appeal. It would go to law. I mean, the thing would be, you know, it might drag on for weeks and months. And now they, particularly when it comes to the on-track behaviour of the drivers, they're pretty quick to apply penalties in race and get the whole thing sorted. So at least you more or less know. So it's only if something happens in the last 10 or 15 laps that it generally tends to sort of trickle on beyond the race and into the stewards' room, you know.
Yeah, so this is, as you said, red flags galore, issues galore, a bit of a crazy Monaco in Formula 1. But then to move down a step to Formula 2, where we had Alex Dunn had probably his most consistently good weekend so far this season.
Yeah, absolutely. It was great. And it was badly needed for Alex, because he'd come off a couple of dodgy incidents with his teammate in the first round. And he definitely needed a clean run through the weekend. And, I mean, he qualified third. He out-qualified his teammate Stensorm, which was the first time this year, actually, in four races. So that was key. I mean, the difference between them is nanoseconds. I mean, it's so, so close. It's a spec formula. Stensorn had sort of third of a season last year, so he's not a complete rookie. And Alex obviously had his season last year. He comes in needing to mount a championship challenge, found himself quite a way behind, qualified third, so he was actually second in his group, because they do two-group qualifying there. So actually, he was that close. He was even closer, when you think about it, to being on pole position than third would appear. And then made a solid start, got it off the line, didn't crash into anyone at the first corner, like as happened last year, and he got a penalty, do you remember, on the back of it? Mm. So it was, honestly, I mean, this is where they're supposed to make mistakes.
Yeah.
This is the point in their career where they're supposed to be finding out. And like what I saw was a guy who did do a really measured and mature performance. You know, he ran through the stint all the way to a late stop. All of the leading runners decided on a late stop, and you know, they're looking for that safety car. It didn't really happen for them. But it played out nicely for me, ultimately converted into a great podium finish in second place. And of course, has drawn level with Stenstorm, now third in the championship and within the show. He's in contention now and heading to Barcelona, which is a good track for him, you know.
Yeah, 15 points behind the leader, Meany. And as you said, going to Barcelona, where last year, on the back of that penalty he had gotten Monaco, put in a fabulous drive to get himself right up there. And despite the fact that in the first three races this season he's had crashes and DNFs and teammate squabbles, he still managed to get a podium in the feature races of those weekends as well. What we saw, I suppose, in Monaco that was so promising was that ninth place in the sprint race, where it's, you're going, okay, this is the kind of consistent point gathering or the consistent performances that you need to try and make sure that you stay in that hunt.
Yeah, just keep tipping away. I mean, it's tough to put together a decent sprint race in a place like Monaco where overtaking is so difficult, with the reverse grid format from the top 10 runners. So obviously he was starting, you know, towards the back of the fast guys. Mm. So it was Leon that got the win, I guess. But it was... absolutely. I mean, consistent. You look at the championship and across the balance of the season. I mean, Fornaroli, who's actually running the McLaren, isn't he, at Barcelona this week in first practice. Did he win a race last year? I think he started to get a couple of wins towards the end of the year, but he was consistently at the head of that championship the whole time without necessarily winning on a regular basis. It's... with the reverse grid formats, with, you know, the fact that it's a spec formula, with the fact that, you know, fortunes will naturally ebb and flow, with the fact that it's far from unusual that they run into each other at this level. I think that's the key. That's going to be the key. And he knows it. And he's performed a perfect act of contrition since the first race. And you've even seen the body language between himself and Stenstorm. It's not quite, they're not mates yet, but Alex is trying to fix everything and he's learning. Yeah.
Looking ahead to Barcelona, like you say, it's a great track. It's a traditional track. What will Alex have to bring to the table to be able to keep securing those podiums going into Barcelona at the weekend?
Top three, top four on the grid, and out-qualify your teammate. That's the agenda. If he can out-qualify his teammate, I think the Rodens are pretty hooked up. I think they're consistently quick this year. And obviously Solov, the Bulgarian guy with Dempy, he's starting to get on a bit of a run now. Gabriele Meany wasn't a great Monaco for him. We'll see whether he can maintain his run, but there's a sort of a lead group of about four or five guys that are showing themselves to be consistently fast.
And what I suppose would be Dunn's goal for this year, obviously when you look at last year, there was not a huge advantage to winning F2 because there was no seats available on the F1 grid, and there was he wasn't in the McLaren Academy anymore, didn't end up going to Red Bull. Now he's vaguely associated with Alpine and their development program. The goal, I suppose, ultimately now is to win.
Yeah, I hope Alpine run him in free practice at some time this year. Mm. Ultimately, I think you're right. I don't think he necessarily absolutely has to win the championship, but I think he needs to win one or two feature races. I think he kind of needs to beat his teammate across the balance of the season in order to be sort of properly on the radar of the F1 teams. He needs to. They need to see two things. They need to see fast and an ability to learn, and fast is the first thing. You know, I mean, and I think so far he's proven himself to be one of those four or five really, really fast guys at this level. So, yeah, he's still in the hunt, 100%.
And going to Formula One again in Barcelona, will we see any major upgrades, do you think? I don't know if you've seen the news that the FIA has determined that the Red Bull actually have the strongest engine across all the grid, which, were you surprised to hear?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's far beyond my ken to understand what this is about, but from what I understand, right, is that they're going to offer the teams that are a little bit behind an opportunity to develop their engines a little bit in 26 and a little bit in 27. They'll give the ones that are really far behind two upgrades a year, and they'll give the ones that are just a little bit behind one upgrade per year. And so then they had to decide what's the benchmark engine, what's the one that's at the top level, and then... And I say engine, I mean power unit, basically. And of course, naturally, as you would expect, at the end of what's been a dominant period for the Mercedes team, the FIA have decided that the benchmark power unit in Formula One is Red Bull. And of course, everyone's going, that doesn't make any sense.
That doesn't translate.
A bit of news to Max Verstappen.
They couldn't get around the first corner with that one last weekend, you know. So it is a bit amazing. Again, from what I understand, that the Red Bull are quite proud of their ICE, their internal combustion engine, their V6 1.6 litre proper engine, and the electrical bits are less efficient or whatever, are not quite hooking up to the same extent. So that's why Mercedes have their current advantage. And that's how, who knows how that calculation is made. And indeed, it's not absolutely 100% set in stone. But I think it's pretty close to being, because everyone signed it. And we will see at some stage later in the year, Mercedes given an opportunity to spend a little bit of money on an upgrade, and Red Bull have to sit there with their arms folded. Yeah.
We've been seeing a few updates are definitely needed for some upgrades. Lando has had 3 power units changed already, I think, in his car. And if he gets a 4th, he'll be then hit with grid penalties and fines. What is happening with McLaren? I feel like we ask this every week, but it's just so different from world champion.
They say it's because they're a customer, and they, you know, it's harder to connect it all up, to get all the data, to be able to sort of integrate it, you know. Again, far beyond my ken. But the fact that they're a customer, and it was interesting that they parked the car, because tactically it would have made sense to leave Norris out there for a bit longer, get him to park the guys up behind him, and then you know, give Piastri a free stop. Yeah. But clearly they're really concerned about the power unit issue, and they want to, you know, not destroy them. Yeah.
Because you have Piastri finishing 4th, probably the best weekend he's kind of had this year, but again, a lot of DNFs around him. Moving just slightly back to Red Bull, you've Isaac Hadjar finishing 3rd, his first podium.
Great drive.
Hopefully he'll retain it as well. He'll keep it. If things aren't overturned for him tomorrow. But
I don't want to say it's his home race, because obviously Monaco is not in France, but in front of a brilliant crowd. He is Rookie of the Year last year, I'm pretty sure he was. Just a fabulous drive.
It was a cracking drive, because he was in all sorts of trouble. And his, of course, his radio traffic is like, he sounds like he's about to jump off a cliff or something. Yeah. Compared to, you know, Lando Norris going, this is not very going very fast. I mean, sometimes I think they don't do themselves any favours by making it sound like they're just going for a drive in the park. But yeah, I mean, Hadjar sounded like he was in all sorts of grief the whole race. I mean, the thing was just a bucking Bronco, and with engine braking and all sorts of challenges, and he just had power. Give me more power. He wanted more power. But he managed to, I mean, Monaco is the only place where he could have pulled off a drive like that, you know, with so many power difficulties, and still managed to be there in the hunt. But he was kind of lucky, wasn't he? Because they at the red flag, they dived in, changing spark plugs and things like that. And the FIA came and said, you can't do that. And they went and put the old spark plugs back in. I mean, they were lucky, actually, to have hung on to it, because clearly that would have been an infraction had they not been told what they were doing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I always find it funny you can do that. Oh, sorry, we'll just put the old ones back. And like, don't penalise us, please.
Very cheeky.
Yeah. Just to run through, just lastly, a few of the more kind of interesting results. You have Lindblad, who finished 6th, Lawson 5th.
Great for racing balls at the weekend.
Yep. Great for Lawson.
Exactly.
Lindblad getting all the attention.
I'm a huge fan of what Lindblad's doing.
He's been very consistent. And you've Ocon finished 9th, probably considering he had qualified in 17th.
Yeah.
But he's good around Monaco. He got the podium a couple of years ago. It's a track he seems to like. And then Fernando Alonso, as we said, getting that last points position. I think he did his immediate post-race interviews before finding out that Perez had got the penalty, and he was like, no positives, the brakes are bad, the engine's bad, and then suddenly finishing 10th. So maybe this will be for Aston Martin what they're going to need to be doing for the rest of the season, which is just ensuring that you are there to capitalise when others are DNFing.
100%. I mean, they'll get better. I mean, they didn't bring any updates to their car just yet. And Adrian Newey turned up in Monaco, so that was a good signal as well. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of saying, look, it's a really tough period, but we've got a proper upgrade coming, you know, quite soon, and that should see a considerable lift. We'll see, because the gap between the Cadillac Aston Martins and the rest is a yawning chasm at the moment, really.
Yeah, and then kind of if you're talking about the best of the rest, obviously the Gasly finishing 7th in the Alpine, Williams having maybe their one of the better weekends, Albon finishing eighth, but then poor Sainz.
Really unfortunate for
Carlos. Hit by Hülkenberg. Hülkenberg, you had a bit of a wacky weekend, qualifying 13th, finishing 13th, hitting people, getting penalties.
That's what I mean, he was kind of forced into going down the inside at the hairpin, wasn't he? Mm. And then by doing that, of course, you haven't got the steering line. I mean, it's just daft to look at them with all hands and thumbs in the car, in car, isn't it? It's the most nuts corner in Formula One. But then he kind of sort of pushes out from there, and Sainz, of course, has no IDs there because they have these trucks these days and they can't see out of them.
You know? Tiny mirror.
Yeah, tiny. That was just dumb luck, really.
So I guess, suppose, to end our Monaco review podcast, I want to ask a very annoying question, which is, do you think that there is still a place for Monaco going forward in Formula One?
Oh, I don't think that... what I would say here would have any influence ever. I mean, it is key.
Yeah.
I think the automobiles themselves are just too big anyway. They're huge. I mean, they're a little bit smaller this year and they're nicer to drive in general. So I think that's a positive development. I don't see the cars getting smaller, but, you know, much smaller. But to be honest, they're just too darn big for most places. And Monaco is just really shows it up. The funny thing is, I mean, if you've ever had a chance to go, I mean, I would recommend going to Monaco. I mean, they never go as slow all year and they never look as quick. I mean, in the context of buildings everywhere and Armco, and they're just sensational to watch. You know, one of the biggest pleasures I've ever had was Monaco, like all the press will always get a tabard and go out on track at that one. They don't necessarily go out at every track, you know, and go to corners and look at it. But at that one, you can get a sort of a race by race tabard. And I used to go to Tabac, you know, the left-hander. So you come through the tunnel, through the chicane that they're now calling the Nouvelle Chicane. All of a sudden, everyone's calling it. Then sort of Tabac is that little left-hander. Yeah. No one ever talks about it. No one ever really notices it. But you could walk up to that and be the ripple of the tarmac, of the Armco, from the drivers. And they would turn in and you would just have this fleeting moment where your eyes were making contact with the driver at sort of, you know, it was 120 kilometers an hour. It's probably a bit more, you know, 140, 150 kilometers an hour. And then they would just brush the Armco just millimeters away and then be gone on their way. And it's just sensational. I mean, it's just a ridiculous place to put a racing car, but absolutely amazing to see it. Yeah,
because I've been to Monaco, not on a race weekend, but it was in between when Formula E were there and when the F1 were kind of about to be set up. So you had the grandstands there and the barriers were there. I remember walking around the city trying to walk the length of the track.
Yeah.
And it if before I was maybe ambivalent toward Monaco, I came out of there thinking this can never leave. There's something I quite like about the magic of
Get is the elevation changes as well. I mean, you know, it is a fair old lift up and into the Casino Square. And the place is just, I mean, what was it, Nelson Piquet? It's like riding a bicycle in your bedroom or whatever. Yeah. It's true. But I think every driver just thinks to be able to nail a really good lap around Monaco is a career defining achievement, you know.
And it's great how accessible it is. I went to Monaco once again, not on a race weekend, but just to get on the little tourist bus and go through. I felt so excited. I felt like a little kid.
We took you an hour to go around the lap, did it? With the traffic.
Actually, it wasn't too bad, but on a beautiful sunny day, it's so exciting to kind of put yourself in the driver's shoes, but not even attempt the pace. It was great.
So obviously we're saying goodbye to Monaco now. We're going to go to Barcelona next week for what is a really hectic European swing, which will be an interesting one for the championship, will be an interesting one for the midfield, and then hopefully some of these backmarkers can keep picking up the points along the way. Declan, thank you very much for this. This is lovely.
Thanks, Kira.
No problem. Thank you, Kira, as well.
Thank you.
And as always, the F1 pod on Off the Ball is brought to you by KitKat, bringing breaks to the fastest sport in the world. Hashtag have a break. Thank you very much.
The Formula One pod on Off the Ball, brought to you by KitKat. Hit pause, have a break,
have a KitKat.